You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to this episode of Meet the Farmers. My guest today, I'm very pleased to say, is Tom Bradshaw, who is an arable farmer and former Nuffield scholar from Essex. His Nuffield report, published in 2012, was titled Soil Fertility and Fertility Use Efficiency, and clearly soil health is very important to his farming philosophy. Three generations of his family were farmers before him, and a small amount of his farming operation is still run on family-owned land here at Fletcher's Farm. However, the majority of his business is based on contract farming arrangements with neighbouring landowners, and in total he farms around, is it around 1,600 hectares, Tom?
It's a little bit less than that now, it's about 1,250 hectares.
1,250 hectares. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. Can you give me some detail about your business and the farm here?
So I returned to the farm here in 2004. I'd done my degree down at Y College in Agricultural Business Management and then had 6 months out in New Zealand working out there on a mixture of very intensive potato and vegetable cropping, and then moved down to the South Island onto a cereal farm. And shortly after returning to the farm, sort of April 2004, we were a small dairy farm, 120 cows, and we were managing another dairy herd in the neighbouring village of about the same sort of size. But I looked at the figures and I said to Dad, look, I just cannot work out how we're making any money out of these cows. And I've been incredibly lucky that rather than Dad saying, look, what do you know, you've only just returned home, he said, well, let's have a look at the figures. We agreed that we weren't making any money out of the cows, and we decided that the time was right to sell them and move on. So the home farm here is now based around a large equestrian centre that we set up following the sale of the cows back in 2004. But in 2002, next door to the contract farm dairy herd in the neighbouring village, there was a 400-acre arable farm coming up for contract. And I think the gentleman in question knew that Dad had three sons and was sort of keen to help another family along the farming ladder. Or Dad rang him and said, would we be able to tender? And he said, yeah, no, by all means, I'll send you all the details. And when his short list of farmers was only two, and both of them had following generations coming along in the business. So I think maybe that was something that he saw as being very important, was sort of helping somebody else up the farming ladder. But all the professional advice was telling us not to do it. We were going to lose money. How could we ever make it work? But that first 400 acres was sort of the stepping stone. And then we were really lucky that 2003, we took on another couple of blocks of land. 2004, we took on another couple of blocks of land. So we very rapidly got to 2,500 acres of contract farming in a three-year period. We did it all on the back of old second-hand machinery, a couple of old American Arctics, a Steiger and a Versatile, which were just amazing tractors. You know, you're sat in there with your earphones on, and if you're lucky, you tune into the radio. That was the only way we could make it work, really, was to have the lowest machinery cost possible.
Let's talk about the equestrian unit. Do you have any interest in horses yourself?
I purely looked at it as a business sort of enterprise, and I think actually initially that was the best thing, because we're not interested in the people, that's not true at all, but we weren't interested in the sob stories, we weren't interested, this is a business. And I think people knew that when they came here as well, that they're expected to pay their money on monthly upfront by direct debit, and it was all set up very businesslike, and actually it's been a real revelation. But again, we got quite lucky with the equestrian, so we decided to sell the cows, and then Mum had seen an advert for Colchester Garrison Saddle Club. We're looking to relocate. So in Colchester, being a big army town, they relocated the barracks back in 2003-04-05. That developed into a sort of riding stables and riding school for military dependents, and then became a public sort of organised. So any member of the public could go and learn to ride there. And when they were relocating the garrison, they sort of thought they would shut the riding school down. And I think the rumour has it that the colonel, who at the time was looking for his MBE, was sat in a meeting in front of 120 ladies, and when he said that he was going to shut the riding school down, he rapidly realised that if there's any chance of getting his MBE, then he ought to rethink his decision. So Mum had seen this advert, and I just rang them up and said, look, we hear you're looking for a new premises. And they said, look, we'll take all your details, but we found somewhere. And so, thank you for ringing, but we won't be taking any further. And then literally the following day, they ran me back and said the place I was supposed to be moving to had all fallen through. This was probably the beginning of June, and we'd got no planning permission for anything at this point. We're still milking cows. And they said, so yeah, the place has fallen through. Can we come and see you? And I was like, yeah, come out. So they came out and they walked into a milking parlour and a sort of a cattle lying yard. And I said, well, this is going to be where the indoor school is. And they were like, you what? And I said, no, don't worry. This will be the indoor school. And then we walked into what was an old pig shed. And I said, yeah, this will be the stables. And they didn't quite have the vision that we had. But then they wanted to move in the middle of August. And we were like, look, there's no way we can do this. We've got to get planning permission. There's no way we can get this ready in 12 weeks, including getting planning permission. I said, what's your absolute latest deadline? And they said, right, it's about the middle of November. And I just said, right, we'll have it ready for the middle of November. And so that autumn, I didn't leave the farm. Dad took charge of all the contracting side of things. I took charge of converting the yard over to the equestrian. And the riding school signed a 15-year tenancy and moved in. And that really just gave us the backbone of a business that we knew we'd got a sensible rent for 15 years for part of the site. And then the livery and everything sort of built on the back of it. So we started with 13 stables and now we've got 70 stables. And then back in April, my wife and I actually bought the riding school. So the garrison were told, or the commander, every time they had an audit, they were told that they shouldn't be running a commercial business outside of the garrison barracks. And they'd approached us a couple of years before and we'd sort of looked at things and decided that we weren't interested. But when they approached us this time, the figures look much better, and we said no. We'd happily look at buying the business. So we've now taken the riding school in hand as well. So that's all going really well.
Yeah, I mean it's a similar story to a lot of ex-dairy farms, and there used to be a lot of dairy farms in Essex.
Yeah, I know.
Which is for something that it's very easy to forget now, being big arable country, known for us being an arable country. But can you take me back to, I suppose, your memories of earlier life on a dairy farm here? And maybe dairying across the county?
Yeah, I mean, so you're dead right. And when I think to around the locality here, I mean, the neighbouring three farms were all dairy farms at one point in time and went out at varying stages. I jokingly say the day that we really miss the dairy cows is Christmas Day, because it was a great excuse to go out and get rid of the Christmas lunch after you sat down and eaten too much. No, I mean, I think that for us, if we hadn't have developed the business, so if every day we walked out to a yard where there used to be a dairy herd, then it would be a lot more difficult. But the fact is that the day the cows went, we started knocking it down and we've got another use for it. So we've never had time to reminisce about them not being here. But for Dad, it was a massive part of his life. You know, he was working in the cows 24/7. That's what he did. That's what he knew. And to sort of except that they weren't making any money, I think took great courage to you know, enable that or allow that change from somebody who'd only just been back at the business for literally weeks. You know, it really was a really bold step by him.
Did you always imagine being a farmer growing up?
My education was at the Colchester Grammar School, and I was incredibly fortunate to go there. And in the sixth form, they turned around to me and said, right, we really think that you should be applying to go to Cambridge to do agricultural economics or agricultural land management, I think it would have been. And I turned around and said, look, I'm not interested in going to Cambridge, I'm going to White College. And at which point they were like, "But," and I said, no, I'm going to White College. And I'd known for a long while that probably that I wanted to go into agriculture, but no way had my parents, I think that they maybe had subtly encouraged it, but we certainly weren't forced to go into farming in any way, shape or form. It was completely our own decisions. But you know, through school, we had to earn our pocket money. And yeah, every other weekend, I used to do the pigs on the farm. So the pigmen would have that weekend off and I'd do the pigs 2 days a week or 2 days of that weekend, and then yeah, we'd rotate that around. I was absolutely sport mad, but I'd always get the pigs done before cricket so that I could then head off to school cricket. And but you know, that was just part of it that was inbred in us. And yeah, at an early age, I knew it was something that I wanted to do. Whether I ever wanted to be a dairy farmer, I probably never had that love for the cows. But it was, you know, I think that like anything, if you're making good money out of it, you'd be willing to do it. But the commitment to it is unbelievable. I mean, those guys are just so committed. And you know, it's a real thankless task if you're not seeing much brass at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, careers advice gets a bit of a bad rap at schools anyway. But we'll say that it's good enough for a young person who's considering agriculture, or perhaps hasn't considered agriculture, but it might be a good line for them. Are we doing enough?
I mean, I've just written a piece for the East Anglian that was published last weekend, and in there I think one of my sum up lines is something like the next decade is an incredibly exciting time for young technologists to be coming into agriculture. The changes we are going to see are going to blow our minds, and yeah, we probably can't even start to think about some of those changes, but we're going to have robots. The use of drones is already mainstream, but we know it's going to become far more advanced in what they're doing. Real-time sensors. You know, if you were a young technologist at the moment, I genuinely think agriculture is one of the places to be looking at going into. Would a careers lecturer or careers advisor have any sort of coherence as to what's going on in agriculture? Not a chance. You know, I think, but it's probably our responsibility as the industry to get out there and shout about it and say, look, you know, you guys who are interested in technology, there's really, really good options here in farming.
Take me back to your days at White College, and tell me some memories from that time.
Yeah, probably the most memorable things aren't memorable and all that stuff. White College is a place where I know my best man was from White College. I was his best man and best man for another lad that I was at White College with. We met a great group of people. I still use my degree now in everyday working, and so I think that particularly the business management side of it. And 18 months ago, a year ago, I was at dinner after shooting with somebody, and a young lad looking at going into university, and he said he wanted to go and study agriculture at university. And my advice to him was actually, I would do the business management side, because you can specialise in the agricultural part at a later date. And I think that business management side gives you so much broader spectrum that you can cover, whereas the agriculture bit narrows it down a little bit. But the business management side for me was really, really relevant. Some of the most memorable things, the champagne breakfasts were always good fun, especially when they were followed by lectures later on in the day. The charity week, I organised one of the charity weeks where we raised several thousand for the air ambulance, which is always you've been able to spend the week getting drunk, but you feel like you're doing it justifiably because it's for charity. We did have a great time, and we talk about it regularly now, but the fact that it was before the modern iPhones and the camera phones and all those sorts of things probably meant that it's a lot less recorded.
Yeah, it's probably a good thing.
Yeah, exactly that, yeah. Yeah.
And you then went off to New Zealand. From why and New Zealand, what ideas were running through your head at that time? And were you thinking about, at that time, returning to the family business? Or were you thinking, I could use my skills elsewhere?
No, so when I went to New Zealand, I'd already decided that I was coming home at that point. The business had grown with the contract farming pretty quickly. And there was we were either going to be taking somebody on to run that, or there was the opportunity to come home. My older brother wanted to go off and do accountancy, and younger brother was probably just about to start Harper. So there was the opportunity there. And so by then I knew that I wanted to come home, but I think we all felt it was important just to have time between university and probably committing for life to the family business. So that 6 months was really, really valuable, actually.
You described the changes, the direct changes, I suppose, to the dairy unit, with the equestrian unit coming in. But what about your arable business, how that took off and those initial years?
I think that we were just very, very hungry in those early years. And I wouldn't ever say we were competitive with the prices we put on into the tendering, but it was all done on the fact that we were using old second-hand machinery rather than new machinery, so the depreciation was a lot lower, potentially repairs a bit higher. But on the back of that, it was very competitive what were the prices that we were putting in. And I think we came up with a different contract farming model before it had become mainstream. We were tendering with two tiers in the profit share, whereas back then most of them were still only one tier. And so once we'd got to a level of profitability we deemed acceptable, we brought in a 50-50 tier. And we started tendering on that basis in 2001, whereas I think a lot of people were caught out by that because it was still very much an 80-20 split. And so that is probably where we actually won a lot of those tenders, was not because we were absolutely the cheapest, but because on the other end, they knew that if in good years, they were going to get more out of it. So I think that's where we won a lot of those tenders. And I think also when there was myself and dad and my elder brother sat around the table, in these meetings, when you sort of the final two or three people being interviewed, they could probably just see the passion, and they probably felt that they wanted to give us a chance. And you know, we still work for most of those people now. There's only one farm that we are not farming now that we have farmed, and the rest of them, you know, we've been, our longest is 15 years. Another one that's 13 years, I suppose, now 14 years. So they're long-term arrangements. We've got good relationships with the people that we're working with. I think it's just about openness and honesty as much as anything, and complete trust. Contract farming is just about trust. And if you've got somebody sat at the other side of the table that you don't believe you can trust, it's never going to work.
What would you say are your strengths, sir?
People often say that I've got an ability to communicate, and that's something that, you know, I in 2013 I did the BBC Harvest program, and that probably is one of the highlights of anything that I've done probably in my life. It was a real eye-opener. I think it was a great platform to communicate farming to the public. Well, I remember the phone rang middle of harvest 2012, and it's so-and-so from the BBC here, and I was like, pardon? And it's so-and-so from the BBC here. Your name's come up several times in conversation. Can we come and visit you? And I was like, yeah, of course you can. Can we come tomorrow? This is the middle of harvest. And I said, well, yeah. And do you mind if we're going to bring the camera with us? We're going to do some mock interviews and just see how you come across on camera. And so anyway, they turned up the following day. It'd been a really damp night. Hadn't been any rain, but been really heavy dew. So I'd got the combine ready. They turned up. We didn't start combining until the afternoon, so it actually fitted really well. And we went off and did these mock interviews. I would love to watch them back now, because I'm sure they would be horrific. But anyway, they'd run my Nuffield paper. That all came from Nuffield. Yeah. And that was the really interesting thing about that, that my name had come up in conversation. They'd read my Nuffield paper, and they just thought, you know, there's something a little bit different here. But that was sold to me on the basis of trying to reconnect the public with farming. And you know, whenever I'm speaking to groups now, I try and impress upon them that is our responsibility. You know, we complain that people have become disconnected with where their food comes from, but we have to ask, whose job is it to maintain that connection? And I think it's our responsibility more than it is their responsibility to understand where their food comes from. So we've got to make sure that we re-establish that link.
Let's turn towards your Nuffield. So you travelled to Germany first, South America, the United States and Australia, and your focus was on soil health. Why and why Nuffield?
I applied to Nuffield. Why did I apply? I knew several Nuffields by that point. I'd had my arm twisted by several of them saying, you know, you'd do a good job of this. The subject was quite easy. I mean, I actually applied to look at the sustainability of UK arable farming. But that was driven by, so we'd always had livestock here at the farm. We used to have sheep, and we had pigs and cows. And all that muck had always gone back onto our soil here. And so we'd always had the benefit of that fertility. And then when we were taking on a lot of these other farms, they'd not had any livestock on them. And the difference in the soil workability was huge, and in the fertility of that soil, in terms of we were using less nitrogen here than we were on other farms. And what I was looking at from Nuffield was how to try and recreate that without necessarily bringing livestock into the system. We decided between myself and Nuffield that the sustainability of UK arable farming was too big a topic, and it, you know, definitely was too big a topic, but the real burning desire to apply had been driven by soil fertility. And so that's what we, you know, were then focused on. But I wanted to look at everything from GM through to organic, because I wanted to come back from Nuffield with a view as to where I thought our farming here, but also UK agriculture, should be heading. And so I wanted to expose myself to the extremes and, you know, both sides of the argument, and just, you know, try and find where I thought we should sit in that that dialogue, as it were. Yeah, I mean, the most challenging 4 days of my Nuffield, without a shadow of a doubt, was the Acres USA conference in the States. We've talked about the real farming conference before we started this interview, and I said, you know, to my mind, the real farming conference is very much an extreme niche at the moment. I don't believe it does represent the real farming, but I would say Acres USA is the same for American agriculture, that it's a real, real niche. And But it really did make me challenge just about everything we were doing in commercial agriculture. You know, from the use of pesticides to fertilizer, why we weren't organic, grass-fed beef, etc., etc. You know, the whole sort of charade was questioned. I mean, it was really powerful to come through that and to still be using fertilizer and to still be using our plant protection products as we sort of deemed necessary, was, I think, quite a powerful thing. But that was definitely the most challenging 4 days I had. You can travel anywhere on an off field, but I think the subject area really isn't that important. It's your group of peers that you meet who, you know, we had a great year group, but also, we were put together in a room for 7 days in New Zealand, the 50 scholars from around the world. And yeah, it was a very, very intense week, late nights, early mornings. And, you know, it really, really was a powerful learning experience.
I've spoken to, I think he was in the cohort before you, previous Meet the Farmers episode with Tim May, who did...
He's my year group.
He was in your year group. And he spoke a little bit about this, but I wonder if you could put a bit more detail as the process of Nuffield itself that people might not understand as to when you apply for Nuffield, what's the process from application through to being accepted and then the aftermath as well?
Yeah, so I mean... The best thing to do for anyone who wants to get an off-field is to get in touch on Twitter or something like that. I'm at ProAgri Limited. I would happily give any advice, or just go to Nuffield Farming Scholarships website. But basically, you decide you've got a subject you're passionate about. And the one thing Nuffield is looking for is passion. They're not looking for highly educated. They're not looking for sort of prim and proper. They are just looking for people who are passionate about their subject area. And it doesn't matter from what walk of life you come. And that is, again, one of the best things about Nuffield is it's such a diverse group. But you've got your subject area, you decide you want to apply, you go online, you fill in the form. You then get sifted through and probably 35 to 40 people get invited to interviews. Your region will offer mock interviews for you so that you to try and sort of help prepare you for that interview process. That is quite an intensive I can't remember now whether it's 10 or 20 minutes, but you're in the room and you could have anything from 6 to 8 people, depending. I mean, so the individual sponsors of Nuffield, some of them are individuals, some of them are organisations, but they will have representatives who turn up at the interviews. Depending, like they'll have shortlisted who they want to interview beforehand, but if you have half a dozen people that have shortlisted your subject and you, then all of a sudden they will be sitting in the room as well to see how you did on the interviews and maybe to ask the odd question. Again, I still think that what they're looking for there is not the polished answers. And there'll always be left field questions. So the one that I got was Julian Assange, hero or villain. And one of my words of advice from somebody beforehand was read the papers in the lead up to your interview. And the day before, I had flicked over an article about Julian Assange and then I'd flicked back and read it because I just thought, you know what, I'll just follow that piece of advice. And anyway, sure enough was the question, Julian Assange hero. There's no right or wrong answer to that.
Yeah.
But the point is they want you to be able to justify what you say. So whether he's a hero or a villain and why, and you've got an answer that makes sense. And they're sort of just thinking about the future that you might end up on a New Zealand radio station for an interview and be asked a question. They don't want Nuffield to look stupid. So, that was one piece of advice. You get selected. So it's very shortly after your interviews, within 2 or 3 days, you'll have been offered a place or you'll have had the dreaded letter saying, I'm afraid that you haven't been accepted this time around. And then really, not a lot. I mean, you go to the Nuffield Conference, so that would be October. You go to the Nuffield Conference in November, but you really start your Nuffield in February, I think, with a few, 2 or 3 days in London, just learning in depth, more sort of a bit of agricultural policy, politics, a bit of sort of team building stuff, just so you get to know each other as the UK scholars. And then after that, you meet up with all the scholars from around the world. And for that particular year. So now we've got Holland, we've got Brazil might be about to come on board. We've certainly got New Zealand, France, Australia, Ireland, and there used to be Zimbabwe, and the hope is that Zimbabwe is coming back on board as well. So you all put together, and then basically after that you go off on your own with this lump of money that you've been given by Nuffield to go and do your subject justice, really.
Did you find it difficult stepping back from the business at that period, Or was it a good learning curve? Or did you take it in your stride, so to speak?
I suppose so. You know, I was praising Dad earlier on for enabling the change when I came home. But Dad's still very involved in the business, and he's never been one for doing the office work. He's always, you know, he's never particularly done the budgeting or the planning, and he's very happy to let me get on with that side of things. But it does mean that when I'm not at the business coalface, there is Dad who is still there running, happily running the day-to-day stuff. So stepping back is actually quite easy. You know, we've got a couple of good staff, and they've probably taken on a bit more responsibility. But their staff inevitably change over time, and that things have changed a bit there. So the lad we've got now is a brilliant lad, but he started off with us as an apprentice, went right the way through the apprenticeship scheme, and he's really working out very well. Yeah, I mean, it's something that I suppose I do more and more off the farm. So it's something that we have to prepare the farm for, is me not being here all the time, but I guess with laptops and mobile phones and it's reasonably easy to work from further afield.
Mentioned in your report is Albrecht soil analysis. For those who don't know, can you explain what Albrecht is and how you came across it?
So, I mean, Albrecht is, what I say to people is ignore the name Albrecht. So Albrecht was a professor, I think was at Missouri State University? But anyway, he came up with what he felt was the ideal soil balance. And then actually, apparently, the human mineral balance should be the same. So what his view is, and there's probably some truth in this, is that if the plants that we eat are healthy, then the human that eats that plant is going to be healthier. Now, that seems pretty logic, and what he was saying is that a lot of the soils that we're growing our crops on are not in balance. And so therefore, a lot of the crops that are grown are in mineral deficiency. So it's inevitable that then the species eating that crop is also going to be in deficiency. That in itself seems reasonably logical to me, reasonably straightforward. What I dislike about Albrecht is it seems to be a bit like Marmite, and that people either love it or hate it. And it really is, I'm just trying to think of the word here, but it sort of creates great emotions and polarizes views significantly. So I actually refer to it as a detailed soil analysis. So when I was in Australia, it was on a farm particular for sale, it was normal to have the soil organic matter percentage, because over there with their relatively dry climate, the amount of soil organic matter is directly related to the amount of moisture that the soil holds, likely to be directly related to their profitability. Over here on a soil analysis, we don't have organic matters. And I'm a real believer that if we're not measuring it, we're not managing it. So people say, what's happened to your organic matters? And the truth is, for most people, they don't have any idea. And I myself included, because we weren't recording it. So people started soil analysis in the 70s, but we don't know what's happened to organic matter levels because we haven't recorded it. Whereas if we'd been recording it and we could now look back and say, well, actually, they've fallen quite significantly or they're stable, we'd be in a much stronger position. So I think that what I really like about the Albrecht, it gives you the cation exchange capacity. So you have spoken with any farmer and they'll all say they've got the heaviest soil. And I'll say, how heavy is your soil? And I know, really heavy, really clay soil, really sticky. That means nothing. That is just one farmer's individual view of how heavy their soil is. Whereas if you have the cation exchange capacity, that will fundamentally tell you how big your soil is. I don't want to generate data just for data's sake, but something that is as important as organic matter. I mean, so in your soil, organic matter is the, for me, is the cornerstone of a soil, in that it's forgiving when the soil's wet, it's holding moisture when the soil's dry. It's a bit like a trampoline, so when you get heavy machinery loads going over it, it will expand out again. So if you've lost your organic matter, then you lose that ability to the resilience of the soil. And so, organic matter, I genuinely do think is the key, but it's working out how we can try and get the organic matter back into our soils. There's only a finite amount of organic matter in the country. Is it realistic to grow our own, or does that create other problems? Are we all going to go back into being livestock farmers? Well, I mean, we haven't mentioned the Brexit word, but at the moment there's a huge cloud over that, depending on where Brexit goes. So, I think that there's some really challenging questions.
What were some of your key take-home messages from your Nuffield? And perhaps on a personal, practical level, How did it change, if at all, the way that you look at your business?
So Nuffield finished 2012, and then we got appointed an AHDB monitor farm in 2014, I think. And then we had a whole review of the business done at that point. I think the two are interlinked, because so Nuffield gave me some... I'm absolutely convinced that in farming, we only have one free energy source, and that is the sun. And yet we have fields sat bare for 6 months of the year. I came back with this terminology. So it was at the time of the Forsyth Report when I did my Nuffield into sustainable intensification. And for me, sustainable intensification is more output per unit of input without negatively impacting the environment. But that was one of the conclusions that I came to in my Nuffield sort of study, was that definition of sustainable intensification. Because people often say it's an oxymoron. But it can't be. If we want 7.5 billion people to live on this planet, say 9 or 10 billion in the future, that cannot be an oxymoron. It has to be possible, because we need more food, and yet we have to do it sustainably, if not regeneratively. So yeah, we can't believe that that is an oxymoron, because if we do, I'm afraid that it's never going to work long term. So there was a definition of that. The sun, as I say, I mean it is free. And if we use that and convert that into whether that be organic matter, I mean, effectively, a farmer's job is to convert sunlight via photosynthesis into energy and into output. And so, the more of that sunlight we capture, the more likely we are to be able to be sustainable long term. And I genuinely believe that, but we have found some challenges. Cover cropping has not been straightforward for us on heavy land. So then we had the business review. I'd done a lot of analysis of our costs, and we were realising that our variable costs were going through the roof. Our fixed costs were, not just ours, but as an industry, were rising dramatically. I was trying to get my head around investing over £300,000 in a tractor. And I was just like, you know what? The world's going mad. We just cannot justify these decisions. So we've ended up going down the, I would say, targeted cultivating, rather than direct drilling. Because what I don't want people to think is that we only direct drill, because not for one moment do we only direct drill. We're working for 7 different landowners.
So by targeted cultivating, in essence, you mean what is suitable for any patch of land?
Yeah, I mean, we still, at the moment, rightly or wrongly, will subsoil a lot of headlands, where they're particularly turning headlands, where they're getting run on. We plough for sugar beet. We've actually bought a very, very shallow cultivator. So we have a lot of spring oats in the rotation now going into wheat. I want the oats to germinate before I've planted my wheat crop. So we run through with this incredibly shallow cultivator just to try and speed up that germination. Because if not, we're just going to be reliant on more in-crop herbicide, which is going to cost me far more than that cultivation passes. So it's about building the whole system rather than being a purist direct driller. And just saying, yes, I'm a direct driller, that's what I do. No, we have still have a lot of our cultivation equipment. What we have done is downsized on tractors. So we've gone away from the quad track to a large wheel tractor. And for sure, that's given us far more flexibility. It means that we've reduced one of the higher tractors, got our costs much more back in line. And I'm much more confident now that we've got a business which is viable sort of for the future than we did have probably 3 or 4 years ago.
How do you approach what's going into your rotation? How flexible is that?
I mean, my rotation really is incredibly flexible. in that, for me, we're a business. We're growing for a market. If the market signals tell me that they want something grown, then we will look to try and grow that crop where we can. We also have to be, our biggest challenge is still blackgrass. Although ryegrass sort of is creeping up as well as a little bit of a challenge. If we go to a field in June, July, and we think that the blackgrass burden or the weed burden is too high to put that back into another autumn crop, it just will not have an autumn crop in it. So it does mean we're farming each field on a field-by-field basis, which can be quite challenging when you're managing blocks of land that are further afield. But we do have to have that flexibility, and I think that's the only way we're going to keep on top of these weed challenges is by reacting to the situation rather than by saying, no, this is my rotation, and sticking to it rigidly.
let's look at the arable sector more broadly. Certainly black grass must be one, but what, in your view, are the major challenges? Not mentioning Brexit at this point, because that has other implications, but what do you think are the major challenges for the arable sector currently?
I suppose it's got to be plant protection products. I have an analogy that when you wake up in the morning, you've got a headache, you don't think twice about taking a Nurofen. Yet when we're going out into a field and trying to cure a disease, it seemed deemed to be wrong to be using something to cure that disease. And I can't comprehend that one is deemed to be fine and the other's not. And the other another analogy I use is that if you're recommended a medicine by your doctor, then that's bound to be okay. And yet what we're using, in often developed by exactly the same companies, is deemed to be poisons. So, you know, how can one, a medicine, which is sort of hailed as the next big advance and going to save millions of lives, be okay, but developed by exactly the same company, a poison that we're using on the land? I just do not understand how the analogies can be so far apart in what we're doing. We saw recently this year with glyphosate that we very, very nearly lost a product, which is probably one of the safest products we use. I think we have a massive responsibility, and I think farmers do take it seriously, that we are trying to minimise the amount of plant protection products we're using. The technologies coming in the next 10 to 15 years, probably 10 years, are going to massively reduce the amount of chemical that we're using. The targeted inputs are going to be, a lot of herbicides are going to be done away with, because I genuinely think we'll have laser weeders, robots going around the field sort of that can identify the crop and the weed. So a lot of herbicides probably won't be required. And then we'll have sensors on the spray nozzle that will tell. So it's very, very highly targeted what we are using. But we're still going to need those plant protection products. You know, we've got this population, 70 million people or whatever in the UK, but 7.5 billion worldwide. And we have a responsibility to feed that population. How can we do that sustainably without plant protection products to maximise our output?
We're just leaving January now. A few weeks ago, you were sitting in Oxford listening to Michael Gove's conference speech. What was your take on that and Gove's vision for farming for the next few years?
I think the most important thing that Michael Gove said was that he would like DEFRA to be a champion of British food and farming. And if that's followed through, I think they are really, really powerful words. Because if you ask any farmer what they think of DEFRA, there would be, I don't think you'd get anyone that would say that, oh yeah, they're a champion of UK food and farming. You know, that we sort of view them as a big brother looking down on us, trying to stop us doing things. And you know, that would be generally how DEFRA are viewed. And if they could really be a champion of UK food and farming, I think that that could transform the way that our industry sort of interacts with government, and just give us a much greater platform for really increasing our productivity. So I think that they were, to me, it's been overlooked as far as I see, but I thought that was the real positive. The rest of it was, a lot of his speech was so full of, I envisage, I would like to see, rather than commitments. So it was full of promise, but very hollow on actual promises. Clearly the environment is going to be at the key, and I don't have any problem the environment being at the centre of UK policy, provided that we can profit from it. At the moment, you can only get income forgone for environmental goods, and what my question would be, why should we do it if we're only getting income forgone? Let's profit from it and have it as a profit centre on our farm, that we're judged on how well we do it. Now that, you know, is something that I think that we can really do, but I do think we need to understand a lot more about what he means by green Brexit. But yeah, that would be my sort of real messages.
Almost every single NGO out there has given a list of priorities. The detail is possibly going a bit too far at this stage, because we don't really know enough. For you, as an arable farmer in the southeast of England, or East Anglia, depending on what your view is in Essex, what would your priorities be post-Brexit?
It's clear the government is saying that direct payments aren't justifiable. And at some point, I think we have to understand their messaging. We have to realise that if we carry on fighting the corner for direct payments, we're probably losing. I think there is huge justification in them myself. Trying to underwrite a cheap food policy then I think that they're really important. They are linked to the environment. 30% of our direct payments are down to environmental greening. So, you know, we have to deliver environmental greening for 30% of that payment. And they do underwrite volatility. But we know that government are saying they're not happy that they're moving on and that they're going. So now we need to be developing our policy. And if UK Arable Farming or UK Farming PLC can put a coherent policy together, put it in front of government and say, this is what we think we can work to, this is what we can deliver. And now a lot of that we're already delivering, but we're probably not very good at saying how we are delivering it. But I think that we need to put that in front of government and get government looking at it and saying, yes, we like that bit, no, we don't like that bit. Because if we're not careful, what will happen in 3 years' time or 2 years' time is that we'll have a policy put in front of us and we'll have been fighting the corner for direct payments, but the policy put in front of us won't have them there. And we'll say, well, we don't like this, we don't like that. And we'll have missed our opportunity to engage. So I think now we really do need to start looking at exactly what we are happy to deliver. I like the idea of looking at field boundaries as a payment method, because you end up, the fields, farming efficiency is massively determined by field size. So if you've got a 100 acre field or if you've got 10 acre fields, it's clear which is going to be more efficient to farm. It's also clear that the 10 acre field are much more likely to have hedges around 10 acres and have more environmental good in that 10 acre field than the 100 acre field. The real cost of managing the field is also in the boundary. So the hedge management, ditch management, stone walls, whatever it might be, is higher in your 10 acres than it is in your 100 acres. So I think maybe we need to start looking at how we can tie that into a government policy, potentially looking at floristically enhanced margins, et cetera, watercourse protection, and those sorts of things. That doesn't penalise the small or the large farmer, but what it says is, well, actually, you've got massive efficiencies of scale, so unless you're willing to break that up with beetle banks or whatever, then you're probably going to get less of a payment. But the guys who've got no efficiencies and no economies of scale are, you know, rewarded with a higher payment. And I quite like the idea of looking into that.
What do you get up to away from farming?
So I don't live on the farm at the moment. And I think it's been particularly when my wife moved up from Kent and when she was, before she was my wife, but it's been really good for us to be 5 minutes from the farm, because it's to remove the pressure. We're now desperate to be on the farm, but I think that just removed the intensity of moving into a family farming environment. So I think that's been absolutely great for us. But I play hockey, so I play hockey for Colchester. I love my cricket, but I really don't manage to find much time to play cricket. It doesn't really fit in.
Pretty bad time.
Fit in that well. I'm off skiing next week, I love my skiing, and thankfully my wife does as well. So we tend to try and make sure we get a week skiing. And now I've got an eight month old boy, and you know, that's sort of taking up any spare time that we have as well. But and then I do a lot of farming politics. I'm involved with the NFU, I chair our regional crops board, and so it means I'm involved in the national crops board, and then let's see where that all ends up over the coming weeks and months.
And plans for the future for your business next few years, is it building on more of the same from the base that you formed, or do you have ideas for new directions?
I sort of now divide our business very much into two, which is the home business on the home farm, 62 hectares here. And we're looking to continually diversify. We've currently got plans in for a swimming pool. So we want to do a private hire type swimming pool where people rent it for half an hour at a time, two sets of changing rooms, so they have quarter of an hour before and after in the changing room. And that's the sort of thing that we're really looking to model on somebody down the Ramsey direction, actually. But that's something that we're working on just at the moment. And so we should know in the next few weeks whether we've got permission for that. And then we've got a swimming school want to rent quite a lot of hours from us as well. And I think there's a really good synergy with the equestrian business. Assuming we get the swimming pool and we decide that we are definitely going ahead with that, then I think we'll follow that with a cafe. Because I think we'll have hit critical mass on the farm then for, you know, visiting people to justify putting a cafe in. So here it's continual diversification. Really, you know, I didn't realise until I was putting some figures together for a presentation, we have 2 million people living within 30 miles of here and 850,000 within 20 miles. Yeah, it's a lot of people, and we've got to try and capitalise and farm chimney pots. And then on the arable side of the business, for me at the moment, it's really about consolidation, just making sure we're doing the best job that we possibly can on the land that we're farming. We're lucky with the weaker exchange rate. The last 2 years have been better, but you know, we've had two okay years, and looks like the one coming might be okay. But you know, the backbone of our income, or the reliable part of our income, is now from the home farm, the equestrian centre, and the riding school. And then really the arable business, it's still incredibly important to me. But you know, the contract farming side of things, I'm not convinced that in 10 years' time we'll still be having the same models that we've got at the moment for contract farming. I don't know what replaces them, and if I knew what replaced them, then I think that's... But at the moment, I don't have any better idea than contract farming. And I don't think it's necessarily going to fit. You know, when we hear government saying that they want the farm, or the actual farmer getting their fingers dirty to get the payment, I'm just slightly concerned as to what the structure of those sorts of agreements is going to look like over the next sort of 10-year period.
We'll leave it there. But thanks so much, Tom. It's been really good to speak to you. Thanks so much for your time.
No, it's been great, and hopefully people will enjoy listening to it.
And that was Tom Bradshaw. Very rarely these days is a farm one-dimensional, and I think Tom's is an example of a farm business that has diversified very well to support the main agricultural enterprise. I really enjoyed speaking to him, and I'm very excited to see where he goes in the future. Next time, I will be talking to four farmers from different parts of the UK who I actually spoke to during my time at the Oxford conferences last month. We'll be talking about the Nature Friendly Farming Network, which recently launched. We'll also be discussing environmental stewardship schemes from across the UK and assess how effective they've been. So I hope you can join me for that. I'm Ben Eagle, and this has been Meet the Farmers. I'd really appreciate, if you haven't already, if you could subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and a reminder that you can catch up with previous episodes at any time at thinkingcountry.com. I hope you can join me next time.